Hi, everybody. This is The Takeaway. I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega for the next 2 days. It's good to have you with us. 1 year ago, President Trump passed a law that promised criminal justice reform across the country.
We call it the First Step Act. I sort of like the idea of just calling it criminal justice reform.
The bipartisan First Step Act authorized the early release of federal prisoners who were convicted of low-level drug offenses and have worked through rehabilitation programs. And 1 year later, more than 3,000 inmates have been released. One of them is Nora Yahya.
I did 10 years in Danbury FCI and then lowered my security level to the camp. And from there, I was released upon the FSA, which put me out March 11, 2019, which took off approximately 3 years of my sentence.
Nora was in for possession and intent to distribute cocaine.
I think one of the excitements of the First Step Act is that people could get closer to their families and continue that bond.
For Nora, besides being away from her children, incarceration meant enduring painful health issues with no relief.
While I was incarcerated, my legs start hurting me, and I also had lymphoma, like two lumps in my legs. So one night, I actually couldn't even get up. They actually had to call the ambulance.
But it was only after her release this year that she was finally able to undergo back surgery.
It completely changed all the pain in my legs. I feel like 100% like the person I was prior to all that happening.
Even after the long overdue medical treatment, for Nora, re-entry was challenging.
It was very hard, not just technology-wise. That's something in its own self that was hard and very challenging. I also started out in a new state, which is New York, but I had to start over with my children who aren't children, who are adults now.
But the First Step Act led her to criminal justice reform organizations that helped guide her post-incarceration life.
They introduced me to a computer program there, which is just the basics of surfing the internet, things that are just totally foreign to me. They also helped me with my medical assistance because I hadn't had the proper medical treatment. And I also took a program to become licensed for a food handler.
Now, Nora works as an advocate for people who are incarcerated.
And I think the First Step app actually opened the door and the eyes of many people for those who are incarcerated and formerly incarcerated.
For more on the First Step Act and where it is 1 year in, I'm joined by Jonathan Terry, policy advisor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and Lewis L. Reed, national organizer for Cut 50, a bipartisan initiative to cut crime and incarceration in half across the country. Thanks to both of you for being here on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Jonathan, first, tell us how the First Step Act is intended to work when it comes to early release.
So the First Step Act includes several provisions for federal prison reform. It eliminates the three-strike rule, which is a law that was originally meant to provide harsher punishments for those who have several federal convictions. So previously, you could get a life sentence for having three convictions, federal convictions. Mm-hmm. That's been reduced to a 25-year sentence. It also extends the 2010 Fair Sentencing Act, which reduced the disparity that could be given in a sentence for selling crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. It also brings people closer to home, ideally. 500 miles is now the limit that people are supposed to be allowed to be away from home when in a federal prison. It includes a lot of other quality of life, you might say, provisions for federal prisons as well. So women who are pregnant are no longer able to be shackled. Juveniles are no longer able to be put in solitary confinement. It also expanded reentry programs, which was mentioned a little bit before. So the process of going back into society after prison is an arduous one. And so the First Step Act apportioned millions of dollars for a lot of those programs to help people as they reenter. It was also meant to create risk assessment tools, which look at someone's record and various other factors to decide whether or not they are a risk to society. And that way, ideally, we are able to look at people, allow them to exit from prison and know, because this person isn't going to be a risk to anyone, we feel okay letting them out even potentially earlier.
Let me ask you about sentence reduction, because as I mentioned just a minute ago, more than 3,000 people have been released now under this act. Can you explain what the process looks like for them to have gotten their sentences reduced?
Right. So a lot of the people who are having their sentences reduced were originally sentenced in the 70s and 80s as a part of the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the First Step Act says that since we sentence people differently now, we are going to look at those sentences that were given before, and if they are no longer in line with what we would sentence you currently, we are going to reduce those sentences. Many of them, those sentences are reduced through petition. Some are reduced automatically. There is also an expansion of good time, which says that if you are incarcerated but you are taking part in programs that are meant to rehabilitate you, whether that's job training or drug treatment or something of that sort, you can have time taken off of your sentence. And so there are different provisions to allow people to reduce their sentences, and about 1,700 people have gotten reductions in their sentence since the First Step Act went into law. And there's a reduction of about 6 years on average for people who have that reduction.
Lewis, let me bring you into the conversation. Jonathan just mentioned the war on drugs in the 70s and 80s. This act is mainly aimed at people who were arrested during that time period. Many of them were Black men. What do we know about the demographics of the people who've been released under the act so far?
You know, for decades, the criminal justice conversation among our political leaders, especially both on the state and national level, could be characterized as a race to the bottom. It was a competition for who could be the toughest on crime, who could lock up the most people and throw away the key. It was also a conversation that was defined by dangerous rhetoric with no regard for empathy or second chances. And, you know, essentially it dehumanized people. I was one of those individuals that was in that conversation. In 2000, I was sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 188 months. And for our listening audience, I don't want to, you know, belabor the point in terms of you using your fingers and toes trying to figure that out. That's approximately 16 years. I served almost 14 years off that 16-year federal prison sentence for white-collar related offenses. Most of the individuals by whom I was incarcerated with were not individuals that had got caught up in the war on drugs in the 70s and 80s. In fact, these individuals were caught up in the mid-90s to the early 2000s, especially after the 1994 Clinton crime bill. 91% of the individuals that were released under that particular provision that Jonathan talked about, as it relates to the crack cocaine provision, 91% of those individuals were African Americans. So let me just quantify these numbers for you for a second. To date, 7,000 people total have been released under the First Step Act. I should say 7,000 people total have received significant reductions, and they have been released under the First Step Act. 91% of those individuals happen to be African Americans who were sentenced under those draconian, crack cocaine laws, particularly pointing back to 1987, moving up to 1994, and up to date until about approximately 2010. That has totaled, that 7,000 number, that has totaled approximately 17,000 years of human freedom that have been restored back to our community. Now think about this. In the Christmas season, Jesus was crucified approximately 2,000 years ago. And if we look at the numbers, that actually places us back into BC. So I think that this is something that is significant. I am literally pulled over on the side of the road, 20 minutes away from MDC Brooklyn, where I am going to be with a family who is going to have their loved one returned back to them in this Christmas season after having served 20 years on a life sentence, and that individual is going to be released as a result of the First Step Act, and that's as a result of the advocacy with people such as myself, Topeka K. Sam, David Savavian, Cut 50's co-founder Van Jones and Jessica Jackson, and the many other advocates and organizations that was in this bipartisan coalition to make sure that we got this bill across the finish line.
Lewis, let me ask you something, because one of the act's major provisions, as Jonathan mentioned earlier, earlier was to place incarcerated individuals within a 500-mile radius of their families so they would be closer to them. Why was that such an important part of this legislation?
Yeah, so the reason why the 500-mile provision is significantly important within the First Step Act is because it does one of several things. Number one, it makes sure that individuals are connected with their families and that those relationships are cultivated between parents and their children. Number two, it brings about a level of proximity to the individual who was incarcerated and also to their community. And number three, it actually reduces the probability of individuals who are incarcerated from participating in issues that very well could bring about institutional infractions. So for instance, if an individual is in proximity to their last known address and they know that they are potentially going to see their mother, their father, their family members, significant others, et cetera, they are going to be less likely to be engaged in fights, assaults, you know, and the likes thereof.
Jonathan, the act, when it was passed last year, it was hailed by President Trump as a huge achievement in being able to bring the two parties together. As Lewis mentioned, it was largely a bipartisan effort. Why did this act appeal to politicians on both sides of the aisle?
So criminal justice reform brings people together in part because there's a strong moral push for it. It's hard to argue in a lot of cases that someone who may have made a mistake should be put away for such a long time. It's also incredibly expensive. We spend billions of dollars incarcerating people.
Especially here in the United States, we have the world's largest prison population.
We do. We have over 2.1 million people in prison in the United States. And I think that regardless of where you fall politically, you can see that we are wasting a lot of money on putting people in cages when those people could be contributing to the economy, those people could be with their families. And so it really brings people together on either side. And of course, Jared Kushner had a father who was incarcerated, and so he understands some of the issues that are being that are at play here, and he was able to help usher along the political coalition that pushed through the First Step Act. And I think that we are also thinking a lot about mass incarceration. The fact that we do have so many people put away, the draconian laws that were just mentioned, have really torn apart communities, and we're able to now fight that together. And I think everyone can see the value in that.
Lewis, I know that you're very involved in communities where people are returning home from prison. Can you talk about some of the biggest hurdles for them once they're out?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that there are things that, you know, are obvious and show up in the stat sheets. You know, these are the things in terms of employment, housing insecurities, et cetera, and the likes thereof. I think that one of the major issues that this First Step Act seeks to remedy is the simplicities of things such as not having an identification card. One of the provisions within the bill actually requires all federal people who are being released to make sure that they have access to appropriate identification. When you think about that, that may not necessarily seem like much, quote unquote, much. But when you think about how an individual could potentially have incidental contact with police, with law enforcement, and that individual could potentially have their term of supervision violated because of incidental contact, because he or she may be in a place where they may be accosted by the police. They could be riding as a passenger in a vehicle. An officer asks for that individual's identification. That individual can't produce it because he or she has not necessarily secured it, because you need an ID just to get an ID, and all the bureaucracy involved with that. That individual could actually be hauled into their local police department just to, you know, check out who they are. And when they are there, that could potentially trigger a violation for police contact. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are things in terms of like employment. Yes, people need to be back not even back, because most of the individuals who are actually incarcerated, they may not necessarily have had employment in the first place. So they need to enter into our workforce. They need to make sure that they have adequate housing. They need to make sure that they have access to appropriate health care. treatment, et cetera. And so one of the things that we're doing at Cut 50 is one of the several following. We have partnered with Lyft through our relationship with Kim Kardashian. They have given us 10,000 free Lyft rideshare credits that we are distributing to individuals who are being released under the First Step Act so that they can have access to, employment opportunities, healthcare opportunities, et cetera. Healthcare appointments, et cetera, I should say. In addition, we have also partnered with Talkspace. Talkspace is the online therapeutic platform so that individuals can decompress from what I call the new PTSD, and that's prison traumatic stress disorder, so that they can have a safe place just to, talk about the traumas or the vicarious trauma that they have actually observed as a result of being incarcerated.
Let me bring Jonathan back in here for just a moment, because this law, I should mention, affects people incarcerated at the federal level. It doesn't even touch the roughly 1.3 million people in state prisons. Are we seeing similar reform movements at the state level, Jonathan?
The federal system incarcerates more than any individual state system, but the state systems account for the vast majority of people in prison. So the federal system is about 10% of the total U.S. Prison population. And so we are seeing some of these reforms being put in place. Not all of them are prison reforms. Some of them are broader criminal justice reforms. But where they are being put in place really depends on the state. New York has just passed new bail laws, which are going to affect shortly, in 2020.
In the new year.
And other places are thinking about, legalizing marijuana, or thinking about how do we safely erase past convictions. And some of that is happening through advocates. Some of it is happening through progressive district attorneys. And so at the state level, not only do you have more people incarcerated, but you have, in some ways, a more complicated system just because so many different actors are involved in making particular decisions. And so we do see these reforms, but it'll be harder to push through in a lot of ways on the state level just to get everyone on board.
And let's talk about politics now on the federal level, because many advocates have acknowledged that the First Step Act is a major victory, but they've also mentioned that the next step is focusing on those who've been found guilty of violent offenses and perhaps even rethinking policing on a grander scale. Would either of those approaches be able to gain bipartisan support, in your opinion, Jonathan?
That's really hard to say. A lot of previous bills that were not able to be passed lost a lot of support because they pushed too far. A lot of advocates say that the First Step Act didn't go far enough because it doesn't eliminate mandatory minimums, because it doesn't push far enough on good time credits. We are wondering about what does electronic monitoring do? There is a new thought within criminal justice reform circles that we are moving towards e-carceration, where people's information will be collected and where we'll know where someone is at all times. We'll have a certain amount of information built up, which is a different kind of captivity in a way. And so there are a lot of sort of fights that are yet to be had, but violent crime in particular is a really difficult one, I think, even for people on the left who have been pushing for various kinds of criminal justice reform for years. Thinking about releasing someone who, may have sold drugs at some point is very different from thinking about what do we do with someone who might have hurt someone on the street, may have even killed someone. And so those will be much harder battles, and I, at this point, can't quite see it receiving bipartisan support. But I think that the First Step Act was fantastic because it showed that there is some possibility. I was once told doing this work that if you don't believe that you can make a difference and push forward, then why are you doing the work at all? So I'll stay optimistic.
Jonathan Terry is a policy advisor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and Lewis L. Reed is a national organizer for Cut 50. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.